Hello, friends. Hello, people of the earth. And welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. I just got back from spending the entire month of August in Edinburgh, Scotland. I finally did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's something I've waited years, my whole career, to do. And I can't believe I waited so long. I absolutely loved it. It's the largest arts festival in the world. There are thousands of shows happening all over the city, big and small. I saw countless one-man performances, plays, comedians. I saw a musical. It was inspiring on every level. And it felt like a roller coaster while it was happening. And once it finished, now I can't wait to get back to Edinburgh and do the festival again, which means writing a new hour of material as soon as I possibly can. One of the great things about doing the festival is all the cool people you get to meet, and performers from all over the world, and actors and comedians, and just everyone at the top of their game in the comedy world and theater performance world. Tommy Shepherd is one of those people. I met Tommy Shepherd. He's reputed, very well known and respected guy. He owns the Stand Comedy Club in Edinburgh, which is one of the most perfect comedy clubs on the planet Earth. The dimensions of it are perfect. It's small, it's intimate, you go downstairs, it's subterranean in a basement, it's got low ceilings. There's a really cool backdrop on the wall, a painting of a kid with a cowboy hat and he's holding a toy gun to his head. It's just cinematically perfect. And Tommy Shepherd is a very respected guy. That he's not a scumbag, he's honest, he loves comedy, he treats people well, and he has, since opening the Stand in Edinburgh, now he has a Stand comedy club in Glasgow, also in Newcastle. He's one of the centerpieces of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I got to know him. I did a set there, and he's got an interesting history. He was in British politics before he ever went into comedy. He's going to explain that in this conversation. But he is one of the most ardent and vocal supporters of Scottish independence. I don't know if you realize what's about to happen next week, but it's a pretty beautiful thing. And I think it just might happen. Next week, Scotland votes on whether or not they can have, or whether or not they want, independence from England and to be their own country. And after thousands of years of people killing each other, and it's just the dream of ancestors dead and long forgotten, that this day would one day happen, that Scotland would be an independent country on its own, and it could happen without there being one single bullet fired and no bloodshed whatsoever. This has been a pretty violent and disgusting year in human history, but there's something really beautiful happening in Scotland right now. I'm glad I was just there for the month leading up to it, and I'm glad I got to talk to Tommy Shepherd all about why this is such a great idea for Scotland and the future of the Scottish people. So he's a very intelligent, wonderful, charismatic, magnanimous man. I'm happy to call him a friend. I'm proud to present to you now the one and only Tommy Shepherd. Tommy Shepherd, ladies and gentlemen, Tommy Shepherd.
How you doing, Tom?
Very great. Now, I just want to start out with saying, in today's world in which we live in, where do you get off being a decent, fair businessman?
Yeah, I'm a sort of accidental businessman, to be honest. I got into this game really as a fan. You know, I was a stand-up comedy fan in London in the 80s when we had the first wave of so-called alternative comedy in those days. And I loved the combination of putting something on the stage where people had something to say, but using humor as the means to say it. But you know, the sort of quality of material that you would find in a theater, and combining that with the ambience of a decent bar, you know. For me, that's always been a winning form of entertainment. And I started really a little club here in Edinburgh in 1995 as a hobby. And I had a full-time job at the time.
Expensive hobby.
Yeah, not really. You know, we had a small room. We started in a room with 27 seats in the basement bar in the old town of Edinburgh. And we, you know, took a fiver in the door, split it. We split it six ways. We used to split it four acts, the technician, and I would keep a sixth back every time to pay for the administration and putting out publicity and stuff like that. So it was a hobby. Then I got made redundant, and 3 years later, I turned a hobby into a business, and we're still paying the bills.
Now, you come from a political background, I heard. Now, disheartened, disenfranchised from the political world? Did you think there was more, am I being too romantic if I paint the picture? You might have thought there was more truth and honesty in the world of comedy instead of politics.
Well, I used to be a full-time organizer for the British Labour Party here in Scotland. I was number two in the hierarchy of the administration. And the way I look at it is that the Labour Party left me rather than I left the Labour Party.
In what way? Their platform of their issues went against the way you felt?
Yeah, a big change in the mid-90s when a new leadership came under Tony Blair, and so-called modernised the party, by which they meant moving to the right. And many of the principles that the party had been founded on were discarded. And I got, you know, my face didn't fit in the new regime, and they eventually made me an offer to leave, and I took the redundancy payment and made it the down payment on the Stand Comedy Club.
Wow, brilliant. Now, for the non-British listener, the Tories are more like the Republican-American party, right? So what would Labour be? I mean, in my communist brain, Labour, you know, I picture guys with pitchforks coming out of factories trying to, you know, form unions and stick together.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, all parties here and in the States are broad alliances, you know. But the Labour Party was a broad left of centre party. It had radical elements within it from quite a left-wing background, but it also had, much more, I suppose, what you would call liberal, I guess, more the type of people who would be in the Democrats in the States, they were in it as well. And it was,
So Labour would be more like the Democrats.
Yeah, I guess so. We use the term here, social democrat.
Yeah.
In the post-war in Western Europe, that was quite a mainstream political credo. And it was sort of, left of centre. It believed in a role for government in intervention in the economy. It believed in having public services that were paid for through general taxation and, health and education and things like that. And a general sort of striving for more equality and more fairness in the distribution of things. And then latterly, I suppose, the environmental thing became a character of that as well, and respect and protection for the environment. So that whole sort of package of policies are what the Labour Party used to represent, and some of them would still claim to represent. Of course, in Scotland, the whole thing's got a different complexion because of the Scottish question and the constitutional question as to whether Scotland should remain part of the United Kingdom or whether it should be an independent country by itself. A big debate at the moment, obviously, and that has conditioned politics in Scotland for all of my lifetime. So you have the Scottish National Party here, which is the main political party in Scotland, which in many ways has taken a lot of the policies and a lot of the supporters who used to associate with the Labour Party. And in fact, the SNP, as they call them, and the Labour Party in Scotland, quite often competing for very much the same section of the electorate, and quite often presenting very, very similar policies, although not with regard to the Constitution, obviously, but in every other respect.
And you are a big yes voter for Scottish independence. I mean, you make no bones about it. And let's jump right into that. I mean, you were Labour. The nice thing about staying in this nice Stockbridge neighborhood where I've been staying, I've been getting these leaflets coming through the door.
Oh, yeah.
And this one came in first. Scottish referendum special.
Yeah.
Gordon Brown, I'm voting no.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was your old party.
That's right.
And they want to vote no.
Yeah, the leadership do, yeah. I mean, all the polls show that the majority of Labour supporters are now voting yes. And there's a big difference of opinion between the people at the top of the party and the grassroots. I mean, I'm not a member of the Scottish National Party. I'm not a supporter of the Scottish National Party. I still would probably regard myself as a Labour supporter. But I've come to a position where I believe we should vote yes in this referendum. It's not a position I would have held even 5 years ago. I've been on a political journey, if you like. And I suppose the main reason why I've reached that conclusion is that I've been working now for 40 years for certain political beliefs, for more social justice, better equality, respect, and all the rest of it, and really not getting very far. And I'm firmly of the view now that it's much easier to achieve the type of social change I believe in if we start first in a small North European country with 5.5 million people, where there's a general sort of probably a general predisposition of the people towards that point of view, than if we remain as part of a much bigger country where there's a general predisposition against that type of view. But independence for Scotland is not about being separate. It's actually about creating our own country, which would work with other countries and very much play a role in the world. It's a very outward-looking internationalist perspective that many people in the Yes campaign have. We won't persuade Gordon Brown of that, because him and many other people take their whole careers and way of life from the formal political institutions in Britain. So it doesn't really offer them very much, but it offers a lot to the ordinary people.
Gordon Brown seems to me like he was kind of like the Gerald Ford of British politics. He didn't stand a chance. And then remember, he left the microphone on when that woman, his oldest supporter, he said, "Get that hideous woman away from me."
That's right. Gaff prone, we call it.
So this pamphlet, I read it, the no thing, 5 positive reasons to be part of the UK. And, you know, it's jobs and your pension and, you know, health and education and everything. And then the yes pamphlets are much bigger and they're more attractive. Scotland's future, what an independence means for you. And this is great. Resource rich, we have just 1% of the EU's population, yet over 20% of Europe's fisheries catch.
Yeah, and 20% of renewable energy. And we still have as much oil left in the ground as has already been taken out. I mean, you know, people say that, it would be economically disastrous for Scotland to be independent. I mean, if you think about it, this is a very well-developed small country in the north of Europe. It's rich in natural resources. It has a very literate and educated population. It has a highly developed social and physical infrastructure. If Scotland can't make it as an independent country, then no country in the world, frankly, could make it. You know, some of the No campaign have been talking about ridiculous East European comparisons of, you know, how we'd be bankrupt and all the rest of it. It's just, it beggars belief, really, because there's no comparison between the economic prospects of an independent Scotland and the economic prospects of an underdeveloped, sometimes, you know, second world country, which is the comparisons they make. And the real comparison is to be made with countries like Norway and Denmark, which are small, you know, North European countries who have the highly developed sort of infrastructure as we have. And they do very well as independent countries. And they also play their role in Europe and their role in the world internationally, you know. So there's no reason why we can't do that. And of course, our closest and hopefully our best neighbors would be England. You know, I keep saying to people that there's two, if you think about it, there's two things going on here. There's a lot of Scottish people walking around with a big chip on their shoulder who think life's terrible and it's all the fault of the English. And there's a lot of, you know, right-wing English people, particularly in the south of the country, who think that up here in Scotland, we're all subsidy junkies and they're funding our great lifestyle. You have independence, you get rid of both of those things at one fell swoop. You know, independence means standing on your own 2 feet. There's nobody left to blame. There's nobody left, nowhere to run to. So it either works or it doesn't, but it's all done to the people that live here. And at the end of the day, that's the principle in which the thing is founded, that, you know, the future of this country ought to be determined by the people who live in it, not by anyone else.
I watched this when I got here. This was like a 6 or 8 hour series documentary by the BBC, The History of Scotland.
All right.
And, you know, it's just white people killing white people, you know, over and over. But, like, King James goes down to England and he puts his Scottish court in there. I thought you guys had already worked this out a long time ago.
Not really, no.
I thought the Scottish seamen had equalized everything. Not really?
Not really. In fact, you know, the people who've never been consulted in all of this over the many hundred years were the actual people who live here. Back when we had the so-called Union of the Crowns, That was, you know, the monarchy, well, the European monarchy sorting out spoils amongst themselves without reference to the ordinary people. And then we had a situation in, you know, when the Act of Union Proper happened in 1707, which came in the wake of a disastrous international adventure by some of the merchants in Scotland, where they tried to set up a colony over in the West Indies, which unfortunately it was a swamp they were trying to set it up in, and it was a disaster, lost an awful lot of money. Country was bankrupt, and the merchant class in Scotland then went to their counterparts in London and decided to form the United Kingdom in order to bail themselves out. But at no stage did anyone consult the people. This referendum on Scotland's independence is the first time the people have ever been asked the question.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch that, the Scottish history, I mean, it's the vote is yes. It's, if you were a Scottish person, in my mind, it's like, Jesus, all the fighting.
What's not to like, you know? What's not to like? I mean, and the remarkable thing is that we're being offered something which very few people get a chance to do. We're being offered the chance to start a new country without a single shot being fired.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes there's acrimony in this debate, but generally speaking, this is a very intelligent and intense debate where, you know, people have different opinions on both sides, but they are conducting it in a democratic fashion. And in a civil fashion. And I think no matter what the vote is, obviously there's going to have to be a process of coming together after the vote and making sure that, you know, people, because a lot of people take different sides in this yes-no debate, but they agree on a lot of other things, you know? These pamphlets you've got are actually, they're sort of arguing the same things. They're saying,
that's,
you know,
it, yeah, there's all pensions
saying,
and
vote this
and
way,
retirement.
It'll be better for jobs, it'll be better for pensions, it'll be
fear
better for services.
Fear over what you hold most dear, you know? Oh my God, am I going to be taken care of in my old age?
Yeah, well, I mean, the no campaign, I suppose, because it's a no campaign, it is essentially negative. I mean, it is trying to whip up anxiety of change and saying, you know, that, oh, you don't know what you're going to get with independence, you're better the devil you know, sort of thing. The truth is the future is always uncertain. The most important thing is to make your own future, to control your own destiny. And you can do that by having an independent government.
I've always found it, you know, every country has a Hooray for Us Day. For the United States, it's the 4th of July,
yeah,
when we got our independence from England. I always found it very interesting that in England, their 4th of July, I mean, like the day for fireworks, the day for celebrations, Hooray for Us Day.
Yeah.
England has Guy Fawkes Day. And I was talking about King James in my, which I never knew before. The Guy Fawkes was trying to kill King James when he put all the dynamite under Parliament, which was the Scottish king. And it was, you know, whatever, he was some Spanish rogue political guy. And England celebrates the day they burned that guy to the stake. Because he almost pulled it off. He almost blew up Parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the plot's unfoiled and he's burned at the stake. And so it's not really a, hey, our country's great day. It's a, hey, we like killed a traitor and burned him at the stake day.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking deep history here. I mean,
but this is their 4th of July.
Yeah, well, sort of. But I mean, you know, the other thing was, I mean, that was a Catholic insurrection that Guy Fawkes was part of against the Protestant. The Protestant Parliament that was in place at the time. And it was all overlain by big debates and religious changes that were happening 400 or 500 years ago. I mean, I think we've moved on. I don't think there's too much instruction we can take from that time in terms of how we vote on the 18th of September. It's, I mean, in fairness to people of England, they have St. George's Day as well on the 23rd of April.
But do they do fireworks?
They don't do fireworks.
Okay, no. I'm talking about the fireworks day. So what would Scottish independence do? I mean, then Scotland would automatically have their independence day that you would celebrate.
Yeah, well, we have a couple of days anyway. We have St. Andrew's Day on the 30th of November, and we have Burns Night on the 25th of January, which are big.
What happens on Burns Night?
One of my comedian friends once convinced people that it was that was the night when people actually went to hospital because they got burns and bonfires, you know. But no, it's called after Robert Burns, the Scottish poet and writer.
Oh yeah, Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah, and My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose. And
are you coming on to me?
So Burns, probably the Scottish Shakespeare, if you like, his birthday is celebrated every year, and there's a lot of mumbo jumbo goes on with it in traditional stuff, and people try and, I mean, everyone tries to put into to attribute to Burns their own beliefs, but it's a big day. It's a big Scottish day, both here and increasingly internationally as well. So I guess if we had independence, we might want to pick one of those days as our national day rather than create a new one. And we always have fireworks at New Year.
On New Year's?
Yeah.
Now, Robert Burns, that, help me with this. It's always kind of confused me. On New Year's Eve, may old acquaintance be forgot. Yeah. What, I got to forget everybody I ever knew just because it's a new year?
I'm not sure that's quite the interpretation.
What's he telling us?
May old acquaintance be forgot.
That's the part I hum.
Yeah, I think he's implying that that old acquaintances shouldn't be forgotten. Actually, I mean,
okay.
It's about.
God damn, I've had it wrong for years.
Keeping friendship, keeping kinship. That's.
What would Scottish independence do to the Fringe Festival? I mean, how much would that change? I mean, I think the English newspapers already sent a big message this year, not sending a lot of critics up for the festival. You think they're already kind of distancing themselves from Scotland by? Were they subliminally making a statement?
No, I don't think that's anything to do with
your own country. Well, you review your own shows.
I don't think it's anything to do with the debate. I think it's more to do with the crisis in media in the UK, and it's an international crisis. I think we've now reached a tipping point where actually print journalism is less important in terms of communication with audiences than online, and simple word of mouth and people making their own recommendations to each other through the internet. That's much more effective now in selling tickets than getting stuff in print. And newspapers are selling less, they're employing fewer journalists, they're cutting back, and one of the things that goes is arts coverage. So I think this is the year actually where we did reach the tipping point, and it will continue. There will come a time when there won't be any newspapers, you know, and we're seeing the beginning of that now.
Was the stand always a welcomed element to the Fringe Festival, or because of because it's all kind of revolves around Bristow Square, even though there's shows all over the city?
Yeah, well, it's only revolved around Bristow Square in the last 10 years, actually. When we started in the 90s, the festival was much more spread across the city. It was a lot smaller, of course. I mean, it has, every year it gets bigger and bigger. And the festival today will sell more than 2 million tickets this month. 20 years ago, it would have been 500,000. So it's like four times bigger than it used to be. And one of the things that's happened over these two decades is the rise of the mega venue, you know, like big organizations which have a cluster of rooms around each other, and they have their own bars and their own big promotional campaigns and stuff. And sometimes if you're a performer and you aren't within the curtilage of these mega venues, it can be very hard to get any sort of recognition or to get an audience for that matter. And one of the reactions to that in recent years has been the growth of the free fringe, with people saying, well, we don't want to pay these overheads to perform because, you know, I mean, to be honest, a few years ago, there was a big debate about pay to play, where, because it was apparent, particularly in the field of stand-up comedy, that a lot of comedians, if they were going to get a room, they had to take a room on the basis of knowing that it would cost them money, knowing that even if they sold every single ticket, there was no way they could pay their overhead because the venues were charging them so much, the publicists were charging them so much, and the accommodation costs were so high. So people came to Edinburgh in order to, you know, if you were arguing for this, you would say to invest money, invest their savings on getting a profile. And we've always felt that was wrong. We when we came into the Fringe, we came with a different idea, which was that we collaborate with performers. We put on a show. We take a risk. If we make money, we split the money. If we don't make money, we cover the costs. That's what being a producer means. You take the risk. You don't transfer the risk to the artist, which is what a lot of these big venues did over the years. And there's been a bit of a rebellion against that, and it's now beginning to even out a bit more, and venues are beginning to spread out a little more, which I think is healthy. I think that's a good thing. And I think some of these big mega venues are going to have to reassess their operation, to be honest.
Well, it's one reason that's kept me away from the Fringe for so many years was that I know comedian friends of mine that have come here and left owing 3, 5, 15, 20,000 pounds.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of money.
So. And it goes against the very reason I went into show business, to work like a donkey for a month and then I owe you money. That's never made any sense.
And the terrible thing is, you get this double whammy. On the one hand, you spend a month working your way through small houses and having a miserable time, and at the end of it, you then have to pay for it all. You know, you don't leave with a check, you leave with an invoice. And actually what used to happen was that the promoters would bring some of these acts up, and in order to pay off their Edinburgh debts, they would essentially work for free for the rest of the year for them. You know, it was almost a form of indenture, which is wrong. So we don't do it that way. No performer.
Yeah, I know you just finished your show. Now I want you to go blow guys at the bus station and help work off this debt.
I mean, I'm proud to say that at the Stand Comedy Club, this is our 19th year in the Fringe, and no comedian has ever played with us and lost money. The worst they can do is make no money, but they've never been, you know, they've never lost money, which is something I'm very proud of. And we work on a simple basis that we put on big shows, we put on small shows for new guys, and the big ones subsidize the small ones, you know. It's Stuart Lee sells every single ticket, and the profit we make off Stuart will fund the small rooms where people are playing to 10 people, you know.
That's beautiful. I mean, it's a well-documented fact that, you know, you've got the fairest deal for acts that want to come to Edinburgh and work your room. And the Stand is the proper best comedy room all year round in Edinburgh.
No, it's pretty much the only permanent one.
I mean,
here,
it's
right?
Like, you know, it's like the Cavern Club in Liverpool, where the Beatles started. That's like for comedy, you know. It's like it's the perfect dimensions. I think the best comedy clubs, you go downstairs.
Yeah,
you know, subterranean.
All my clubs are in basements,
and there's just something about that—a dark, low ceiling place, and just the intimacy. You know, I did it last Friday, the late set, and the crowd was a little touchy. We can talk about that in a minute. But, I mean, like the rise in Britain of these big arena shows, like the O2 Arena.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's disgusting,
and it's going to kill comedy in this on this island. But it's rooms like yours that'll save it, and those quality rooms will never go away, because that's how comedy should be.
It's also rooms like ours which are essential for people to start in the business, you know? I mean, no one starts in the O2. You have to start somewhere, and you start in a small room. And it's important, I think, that the people that run it and the people that organize it are supportive to what you're trying to do. You know, there's no point. This is why sometimes you find bars who want to put on a comedy night because they realize they've got a slow night on a Wednesday or something, so they think we'll stick on
trivia night's not working on Tuesday.
Yeah, so we'll stick on a comedy show, but you know, they don't do it properly. I mean, it's not rocket science, but things like, you know, you put the house lights off when the show's on, you know. You have an intermission for the bar, you don't have noise going the whole time. You point the lights the right way. I remember going to a gig once and being told that well, you know, we've only got the one electrical socket, so you can have light or you can have mics, whatever you want, you choose.
Your choice. Lights or sound.
It's really not difficult to organize a decent gig, but it's amazing how many people get it wrong. And I think the reason why they do is because they're not doing it for the comedy. And that's what's different about the Stand. The people who started it, the people who still run it, do it because they like what's on the stage, and the stage comes first. Everything is subservient to the stage. Yeah, we have to sell on the bar to cover our rent, but you know, everything is about what happens on the stage. And unfortunately, that's not the case in many other gigs.
You got total loyalty from any comedian who's ever worked for you.
I wouldn't say total.
I'm sure there's been some prickly issues with certain people. That's life. But I mean, before I ever met you, and the way comedians talk about you, you have incredible loyalty, and then you have a lot of
it's kind of you to say
your staff has worked for you for years.
Yeah, yeah.
There's obviously this really, you know, loving, great environment there. And visually, cinematically, artistically, this backdrop you have on the wall is this painting of this, he's like a kid with a cowboy hat and he's got a toy gun to his head.
Yeah.
Can you explain to me the significance and meaning of that, please?
place. Yeah, we didn't have that when we started. Actually, it was one of our first assistant managers, a good friend of mine called Thomas McGregor. He was an artist. He now teaches art in prison down south.
Attaboy, Tommy.
And he drew this picture, which was actually based on his kid brother at the time. And it's a 10-year-old kid in a cowboy costume with a toy gun. And he painted it with the kid standing there with a gun to his head, but talking into a microphone. And when I saw it, I thought, well, that just sums up really the so much of what we're trying to do. Because particularly for someone starting out in comedy, you feel you've got something to say, you want to try and get it out into the microphone, but it also feels like you're shooting yourself in the head. You know, there's that terrible paradox between wanting to express but being terrified of will the audience like me, or will this work, you know? So we thought that picture just summed it up really well. And also the fact that it's an androgynous, naive character that's in the painting, I think is very important as well, because it sums up in many ways the naivete of the budding comedian when they're starting out and trying to make mistakes and find their voice, you know? So for us, that was what the painting was about. Of course, it's been controversial over the years. We once were refused an advertising campaign on the local bus company because their PR company thought that we were encouraging infanticide and encouraging children to shoot each other in the head, which really sort of mistook the point that it was a toy gun, and so obviously so. But anyway. But it's been, that's we've used that image now for over 15 years, and actually that little stylized painting has pretty much become the stand logo. I mean, you see that now on badges or whatever, or buttons as you call them. And people think, oh, that's the Stand Comedy Club. You don't even need to use the words.
So, yeah, it's one of the coolest logos.
A good position
ever.
To be.
What have been some of your personal favorite moments in the history of the Stand, Edinburgh?
Well, there's been so many, you know. I still... takes a lot to make me laugh these days, I suppose, but I still stand at the back of the room and laugh out loud. And I just think, I feel I'm very privileged, really, because, you know, where else can you be in a situation, where else can you be running a business where the more happiness you create, the more joy you create in a room, and the more people that are there laughing, the better it is for the business, you know? It's a remarkable position to be in. And it's, you have this win-win situation when things are going good for the performer, going good for the audience, they're also going good for the company. And I feel very privileged. Not many people get the chance to run a business like this or to turn their hobby into a business and to actually work at doing something they not only believe in, but that they enjoy. So there'll be many highlights along the way. I mean, I don't know, we've had some incredible nights. At all the clubs, really, but you're familiar with a guy called Johnny Vegas?
Yeah, Johnny,
So Johnny sort of cut his teeth with us, and then he became quite big in this country, but he would still come back. I mean, like they all do, the guys make it, but they come back and play the small club. So, and I remember some fantastic nights with Johnny when he would always improvise and do really wacky stuff. And one night he came from backstage dragging with him this piece of electrical equipment. It was a floor buffer that we use for buffing up the floors, polishing. And he said, what's this? And he pulls it on stage, sets it on a table, gets a member of the audience to then plug it into the electrical socket, switches it on and spins like a spinning top and then projects into the audience, crashing several tables and glasses at the same time. My bar manager's going spare, things screaming, health and safety. But we can't, the room's so packed, we can't actually get to the front to switch the damn machine off. And it's just, it was indicative of the sort of things that Johnny would get up to, you know. Other times he would lie in the tables and get all the women in the audience to come with the little tea light candles and put them on his body to turn them into a birthday cake and things like this. So there were some incredible nights. But I mean, I suppose also one of the nice things now actually is to play a trick in the audience where you have a special guest and they don't know, you know, and like, you know, we've done this several times where somebody wants a bit of stage time and like a really high profile person like John Bishop or something here, who's like an arena act. So the MC will just say, "We've got a special guest. Please welcome John Bishop." And people saying, what did they say? What did jump? Oh my God, it's him! It's him! And they all start. And you play this trick in the audience, which I find quite amusing, to be honest. It's good. And we got others, like a guy called Kevin Bridges, very, very big act here in Scotland. Probably not known, well, increasingly in Australia and stuff as well, but not known stateside. But Kevin would be similar. He always comes back to do new stuff at the club and pops up from time to time and surprises the audience. So that's good.
Other than Billy Connolly, who are the greatest Scottish comedians of all time?
Well, opinion would be divided on that matter. I mean, some people would go back before Connolly to look at people like Stanley Baxter. Other people would say that actually some of the people that have come since Connolly, Frankie Boyle, Kevin Bridges being two, both of which started at the Stand.
I don't know Frankie. I don't know Kevin. I know the work of Frankie Boyle. Yeah. I've never met. I love him.
Well, Frankie's very, very much on the dark side of comedy.
I think he's the vanguard of the proletariat.
Yeah, to some extent, he's
got some.
Always, he takes no prisoners. That's for sure. Kevin Bridges is now much bigger than Billy Connolly, for example. He'll some would take us, and Billy will. Although Billy Connolly's very much held in a lot of affection because he was a bit of a pathfinder in the 1970s.
He kind of changed comedy in Great Britain, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it went from mother-in-law joke era to the performance art monologist that today's stand-up comedy has become.
Yeah, and he took
the American style that we were doing. You guys had kind of like the old.
There were some guys in America.
Brown suit comedians at birthday parties.
I mean, America probably led the way in the 60s with some people, but Connolly. The thing about Connolly is that he was also very blue collar as well. I mean, so he spoke to the ordinary man and woman in the street in a way that, you know, BBC controlled light entertainment was always very middle class and very Oxford and Cambridge. It was, it never really spoke to ordinary people. So Billy Connolly talked to people about everyday life, and he also was very iconoclastic. He just, he lambasted religion, he lambasted politicians in a way that people were talking about in the bars, but you never saw on stage, and you certainly never saw on television. And that sort of broke a mold in the 1970s for comedy performance. And many people since have learned and taken inspiration from that. Of course, there are many of the younger acts starting who just try and copy it, which is not helpful neither, but we usually weed them out.
You can always just see people's influences when they're starting out open mic nights. Oh, that guy loves Doug Stanhope. That guy loves.
There's a difference between being influenced and memorizing a DVD.
Okay. You've got the Stand Edinburgh was the first one, and now you have the Stand Newcastle and Glasgow.
Yeah, Glasgow came second. Glasgow opened in 2000, just a couple of years after we opened the building in Edinburgh, and then we spent a long time trying to figure out where to go next, and we did look at several other places in Scotland, and they just weren't big enough because we only do comedy. We don't, we don't run a comedy night. We run full-time comedy venues 7 nights a week, and it does take a certain population base to be able to sustain that. And we wouldn't be interested in putting a night into somebody else's bar or a night into a music room or whatever. We only do comedy. So you need a couple of million population to be able to make that work. And we looked at other places in Scotland and concluded we just couldn't stack it up. So then we decided to go over the border south. And if they can come here, well, we can go there. And we set our eyes in the northeast of England in Newcastle, where we opened our third club 3 years ago. And it's actually our biggest. And it's been great. Some people, I think a lot of the comics prefer whatever room they started in. So you'll have some people saying, oh, the Edinburgh club's the best, and others saying the Glasgow. And a lot of people now saying, oh, the Newcastle club's even better than that. So
it seems to me, from what I've experienced, the northern part of Britain or future independent Scotland likes more darker kind of humor.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's been like, especially my month in Edinburgh, like my darkest jokes have gotten like the biggest laughs and applause.
Yeah, absolutely.
Breaks.
I mean, we do. And, you know, humor is something that human beings use to try and cope with tragedy and adversity. You know, if something's really shit in your life, then making a joke about it's one of the ways that people deal about it. So I think that's why, because this is there's a lot of people with a lot of problems. That's one of the reasons why dark comedy works very well here. It's also another element of it is that it's just a lot of it's very industrial. You know, I mean, it's working class blue collar humor, which is very sweary. And, you know, people here use swear words as part of their vocabulary to a much greater extent than they would in the leafy suburbs of southern England. And I think that's right. I think that what goes on the stage should be the same language that the audience use themselves.
Great. I was excited to do a set. And I did The Late Show here last Friday. And then they were touchy about a couple lines. And you said, they can be judgmental here. You told me that afterwards. But I stayed for the whole show after you left.
Yeah.
They weren't judgmental with those other comedians.
Remind me, what were the lines you thought were tricky?
I forget. We're all black inside. There was a couple that and they went, it was not that provocative.
In fairness, I have to say that, you know, the gig you played the fringe gigs aren't our typical audience.
Oh, good, yeah, great.
You have to.
Great, so I can remove that from my brain.
You can, because you have to remember that during the festival, more than half the audience are visitors. I mean, maybe three quarters. I think actually the MC called out who's from Edinburgh, and it was like a handful of people. You know, most of the room were probably from London, to be honest, where you get your liberal middle classes who are very sensitive and very politically correct, and they listen to a joke and, you know, it has to run through their brain a few times before they decide whether they can laugh at it or not, you know. So maybe there were too many of those people in on that particular.
Great, good. Someone told me, I forget, in the last week or two when your name came up, they said, Tommy appreciates a good dirty joke.
A dirty joke.
Or I forget how they meant it. Maybe not dirty, but like I think that's quite a statement that you just said, that you don't mind the performer on stage using the same language as the people in the audience.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Well, there's a lot of Puritans, especially in American comedy clubs, where...
You can't say cunt there, can you? Really?
Can't say cunt, people with the... Oh, my God, they'd call the fire department on you.
We use it as punctuation here.
Yeah, that word is absolutely forbidden in this day.
Really? Well, it's been very much reclaimed here, I think. I mean, even there is a strand of feminist thought that is still against it, although there's most of the female comedians I work with are more than happy to reclaim that word and use it on stage. And it's like any word, by using it, you take away, if a word has a particularly negative meaning, then the more you use it in a different way, the more you undermine that meaning.
Yeah, that was the old Lenny Bruce joke about the N-word with black people.
And yeah. If can you say nigger on your podcast?
I can, yeah. I try not to use it, yeah.
Frankie Boyle's got a whole routine about it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What knowledge nuggets about Scotland can you delight the listener with?
It's bloody cold, but...
Yeah, it's been a... you call August is hilarious.
Yeah, this has been a bad August. This has been the worst in 10 years. Last year, we had lovely weather, so it's atypical. But the weather apart, this is a beautiful country. I mean, you only have to travel 20 minutes from here to see fantastic mountains and lochs and, fantastic physical scenery. It also has a remarkably friendly and welcoming population. Any of your listeners want to come here, they'll be given a very warm welcome. They'll be treated well. So, and increasingly, Scotland is becoming a self-confident country that wants to do more than be part of another country. It wants to stand on its own two feet. And you see that reflected actually in Scottish culture. I mean, in the arts, we've a lot of new playwrights, a lot of new authors, a lot of new comedians, a lot of new performers coming through. very much defining a contemporary Scottish vernacular in terms of the arts, which is distinctive and of the moment and of the place, which is very encouraging. That's very, it's a very lively place, you know. We've got a great, great cultural scene here as well.
Other than Sean Connery, who is the greatest Scottish actor?
Oh, of gosh. All time? Pass, I don't know.
Top two, three? Or can you just name one? Okay, all right, maybe they're not known for their acting.
Scottish actor? I don't know.
What's the greatest Scottish rock and roll band of all time? I'd say Teenage Fan Club.
Maybe. Other people might say Primal Scream. The Proclaimers, probably. I think perennial favorite, you know, whether you're 8 or 80. People like the Proclaimers. I don't do you that go down.
I don't remember the Proclaimers. No, you know, but I remember Primal Scream. I didn't even know they were Scottish. That was a great band.
Yeah. Some big. I mean, obviously some big Scottish bands at the minute. Calvin Harris, Biffy Clyro, people like that.
This is of the now.
Yeah, and Harris, I think, pretty big in the States. Calvin Harris.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of him.
Oh, there you go.
I've missed a lot. I didn't know who Kevin Bridges was.
Well, in fairness, I'm probably the wrong age to be asking about rock music.
I think you got your pulse on Scottish entertainment.
I'm at the age for jazz.
Yeah, but I mean, you're around comedians, and comedians always know what the coolest things are. So I mean,
I don't know about that, but yeah, I mean, there's a very lively band scene in Scotland. There's a very lively comedy scene, theatre. You know, on Edinburgh, we've got, I mean, obviously during this Edinburgh Festival Fringe is the biggest arts festival in the world by some measure. I mean, over 2 million tickets in 3.5 weeks. There's like about 300 impromptu venues all over the city. Seems like every church hall in it has just press ganged in to become a pop-up venue. But even when that's all gone, we still have, you know, we have 6 permanent full-time theatre companies in the city. We have some great venues. We've got a very live music scene. Although, I suppose, if you go to Glasgow, it's even better. I mean, the club and music scene in Glasgow is probably...
It's all that heroin brings out the art.
Yeah, probably the best in the UK, to be honest, I mean, a lot of people say. So it's Scotland's a very, you know, it's got its history and it's got its traditions and all that stuff, but it also has a very lively, contemporary feel about it as well.
Yeah, what was I just going to ask you? With the kilt, what's the purse about?
The what?
When you wear a kilt, why's the guy got to have a little purse right in front of his
package? Oh, it's where you put stuff on. It's where you put your cigarettes. Actually, I've got a kilt and I don't have a sporran, as they call it. It's part of the traditional Highland dress. You'll have to Google this. I mean, there was, if you go, the kilt was really developed from just peasant people when they used to wear blankets, really.
Why would one of the coldest places on planet Earth men wear dresses?
Yeah.
Where it's windy.
You ever worn a kilt? It's actually pretty
comfortable. I mean, but you want to protect your genitals because that's...
Yeah, it's pretty warm under there.
For procreation.
Pretty warm in there, man.
Wouldn't long pants have been better here?
You've got 9 yards of wool, you know? There's a lot of plaits and stuff. It's pretty warm to wear a kilt.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Rather than a pair of thin cotton pants or something, it's much better.
And what was the development of the bagpipe? What a bizarre instrument.
You're getting me on my knowledge base.
You're my Buddha of Scotland. So.
Well, I'm Irish, remember, so I'm not...
Yeah, yeah, Northern Ireland.
Yeah, but...
But these people, you know, I mean,
of course, they say the Irish invented
both
the bagpipes
and the Vikings and all the boats. I mean, you know, it's all
the same gene pool. I don't know. I mean, well, the bagpipe is like there's a thing called the Gillian pipes in Ireland, which are very similar, except you don't have to blow in them. You can just use your elbow to inflate them. But I guess the idea of separating the...
I thought Marty Feldman invented that. I thought it was more of a comedic move.
I think the pipes came up. I mean, the thing about the pipes is that it separates the playing of the actual pipe from the blowing, if you like. You know what I mean? Like you fill the bag with air and then you can slowly ease it out while you can play. So you can get a lot more music out of it than you could if you were trying to blow into the thing. you know, like a woodwind instrument or something, I guess. Why they came about, I don't know. I hate bagpipes, to be honest. I mean,
whew, thank God for saying that. I think it's the most annoying instrument ever created.
In the city, by the station in the city center, you have the pipers. You know, sometimes they're doing like selections from Elvis sometimes. I mean, it's like just no end to the stuff that they come out. But it all sounds like an appalling drone, really. That said, there are some contemporary Scottish bands who have reclaimed the bagpipe and used it as an instrument in a contemporary format where it's a lot better. But traditional bagpipes, no thanks.
Yeah, Steve Earle uses bagpipes at the beginning of Copperhead Road, which is a really cool song.
All right, but I didn't realize it.
But bagpipes on their own have always I found kind of irritating. I always hated when a cop of Scottish descent is killed in the United States because
they play the pipe.
Someone's going to pull out the bagpipes. It's bad enough an officer's down. Now we got to pull out the bagpipes. Well, thank you for answering these trivial little Scottish questions for me. But now, how did this year's Fringe Festival compare to other ones for you?
It's been a story of inside good, outside bad. I mean, in terms of the box office, we've had a record year. I didn't think The Stand could do many more tickets, to be honest, because most of the shows are pretty full, but we've managed. We've done 75,000 tickets in the month of August in The Stand
Comedy. Wow.
Yeah, that's over five rooms, but it's quite remarkable, you know, the size of the rooms.
Yeah.
So that's up a good 10% on last year. And I'm quite surprised at it because, you know, when you start here, you see at 11 o'clock in the morning, you're Bridget Christie, then John Bishop, then Stuart Lee. I mean,
starts at 11 in the morning? Holy
yeah,
shit.
Bridget Christie just shows at 10 past 11 a.m. So and we have sellout. So you wonder how we can squeeze extra tickets into this, to be honest. But Stand 3 has done a lot better, bigger shows. Things like the One Man Breaking Bad that we put on at midnight, for example. So, but we're pushing every sort of hour and
guy in charge
out of the venues. And at the Assembly Rooms, which is the more sort of posh venue that I run on the up in the centre of town, that's been a record. We're up 25%. So the tickets have been fantastic. Record year. The downside is with the weather, because like most of the major venues in the festival, we have an outdoor area where we, you know, a drinking area and stuff. And that to pay for that, people have to buy cold beer, and no one wants a cold beer when it's 12 degrees. So we are way below our targets. And I'm in a weird situation this year where my box office will probably subsidize my bars, which is not really the business model that we had in mind. So, but you win some, you lose some. Overall, we'll break even, and we live to fight another day.
What were your favorite shows that you saw this year?
I love some of the theater stuff that I had on at the Assembly Rooms. Unlike most of the other venues, actually, we've got quite a few shows in our program that relate to this referendum debate that's happening in Scotland. And there were two in particular at the Assembly Rooms which I thought were stunning. One was a play by David Heyman, who actually would be in my top 10 Scottish actors. He's probably not in the States, but he's a big television
I knew you had one in here.
Actor here. He did a show called The Pitiless Storm, which was about an old trade union official, a working class guy in the west of Scotland, who gets a medal. He gets an OBE from the Queen, and he's rehearsing his acceptance speech. And in going through and looking back in his life, he realizes that actually it's all a bit shit, and he's going to vote yes, even though he would never have dreamed of doing so before he started thinking about it. And that sort of sums up the paradox that's there for a lot of people in this country, because, you know, they've supported Labour governments in the UK, they've built up the National Health Service, they have this notion of solidarity throughout Britain, but at the same time, they want to be able to do stuff in their own country. And, you know, the leaflet you showed me at the beginning from the Labour Party saying vote no, the message from the Labour leadership is saying you cannot support the Labour Party, you cannot support these ideas and vote for an independent Scotland. Actually, the truth is you can. You can support.
I mean, in effect, they're putting their entire party onto the roulette wheel by saying that. They could lose their entire voter base by saying...
That is a big risk.
With that kind of threat?
If there's a yes vote, it will spell the end for the Labour Party. I mean, I think basically the membership will form a new party and ditch the leadership. That's a very big risk for them indeed, yeah. Likewise, the Scottish National Party will probably split apart if there's a yes vote, because it's a broad coalition of lots of different people who don't agree on many things apart from the need for an independent country. So, yeah, big changes, I think. And big changes even if it's a no vote, to be honest. I mean, the fallout, there's been an intense political debate here which has energized people in a way that I've never seen. I mean, I've seen little sort of meetings in town halls and community halls. Hundreds of people coming out on a wet Tuesday night to hear about this debate. We'd never have had that a few years ago. Never. And all of that energy is going to go somewhere. So I think there's change is going to happen, whatever happens. The other play that I saw was a thing called The Pure, the Dead, and the Brilliant, which was about the referendum, but it was basically the four characters in it were all mythical characters from Scottish folklore. And it was spanned over 1,000 years. It was a very ambitious sort of writing project, but incredibly funny. More gags in it than many stand-up shows that I've actually seen. So my theatre shows at the Assembly Rooms I'm very proud of, and they've been really, really good. Saw some fantastic comedy shows as well. I think for me, the standout would be Josie Long, who was over at Stand One. She did a show this year, actually. I just thought it was... You know, you can tell a show is good when you don't even realize you've got to the end of it. You're not looking at your watch.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I've learned that this month.
Yeah, it just went through. I mean, other shows, I'm, you know, looking at the phone wondering how long there is to go.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. 30 more minutes.
Yeah. You can always leave.
Yeah, but... you told me you were one of the few people who said they liked that Siddhartha musical.
Yeah.
And I went to see it with my wife on her off night. It was fantastic.
Well, I said it was an impressive production. I
mean, it's sexy.
Yeah.
Every person on that stage was sexy. And the guy's poster was all over the city. He's like Siddhartha, but he's the...
he's a hunk.
He's a hunk. Yeah. Long-haired, sexy dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all Italian. So the musical was in Italian.
The words are all in Italian with subtitles, but it's one of these things where it's like opera, isn't it? It doesn't really matter what the words are. It's the performance and the singing and the dancing and the spectacle. I mean, that was the biggest show I've ever done. I mean,
you put on the shows over there as well?
I run these.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Well, in fairness, I can't claim too much credit. I just provided the room in that instance. It was it's actually a New York production company that brought it in.
So you're not spending part of the year traveling around Italy with like a monocle and an ascot?
No,
I will take in Milan's musical season.
No, that's what YouTube's for.
Never have to put your pants on.
Although you want to watch it because there's some promoters in the city who will give themselves a holiday going to all these other arts festivals under the guise of, you know, looking for product.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people.
And you find that their expenses end up in your bill for performing here.
Mm. So. What is the greatest lesson you've learned from Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
The greatest lesson that it is possible to create a platform for people to perform without them having to rob a bank to be able to do it. You know, because my greatest concern, I mean, people talk about this being an open access arts festival in the sense that anyone can just come and perform here. But that's true on paper, but that's not really true in practice, because the truth is there are various gatekeepers to the program, which are the big venues. And unless you've got a lot of money or a lot of profile, you're not going to get into their program. So the rich kids win, you know, and that's always been a concern for me. I want to be able to provide a venue where, you know, a young working class comic who doesn't have a lot of money would be able to come and participate in this festival without having to, you know, go into debt or whatever, and without having to lose money that they would otherwise use to feed their family, you know. So, and if we don't keep that open, then the whole art form gets skewed. You know, it just becomes middle class people talking to middle class people about and letting things run through their head a few times before they decide if they can laugh at a joke. You know?
What advice would you give to any performer, mostly, I mean, comedians or any performer, to come to Edinburgh, the Fringe Festival?
Come and visit first. You know, drop in for a few days, find out what it's about, take the temperature, ask people about the different deals that are on offer. Don't trust your promoter, right? Think, you know, shop around and try and find out the range of options that you might have. That would be one thing. The other thing would be don't come until you're ready. There are too many guys, particularly in comedy, who are stretching out a 20-minute set to 55 minutes. And you can see the padding, you know. So don't come unless you've actually got a full show with something to say that's worked out and doesn't have to be rehearsed and slick. I mean, in many ways, that's the beauty of doing 24 nights in a row. You end up with a different show than you start with because it tightens up, it gets better, and you refine it as you go through. But the idea has to be complete before you start. You know, you have to have, the treatment has to be there. And too many people are coming with not enough ideas to fill the hour. So don't come until you're ready and do a wee bit of research before you come.
And that's exactly why I waited until I'd been doing comedy for 30 years before I came to this beast.
Yeah, maybe you left it too long.
Maybe
time,
a
huh?
little too long. But I would come here just as a tourist for this festival.
Yeah, well, a lot of people
I mean,
do.
Great city, and Jesus Christ, just so many shows going on.
Yeah,
I mean, today
so
I saw the Quentin Crisp thing. The guy was amazing. And then I saw The Collector, this political play about Abu Ghraib, which was really intense. You know, the other day I saw the Scaramouche Jones last week, which was brilliantly acted. I mean, like, you know, in the course of a day, like seeing multiple shows, I cried, I laughed, you know. It's insane and titillating how many emotions you can go through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's nothing like the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. I mean, it, just in its scale, there is nothing like it. You can wander around these streets and take potluck. You know, you just go into a little bar and something's happening that's out of this world, you know. And I don't think there's any, I mean, there are other festivals in other cities, but nothing in this scale. So if you've not been, come.
What is the greatest advice you've ever been given in comedy?
I'm not a performer.
I never
have tried to be. Advice, I mean...
Even if it pertains to running a comedy club.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to come across sounding pompous, but I mean, we've sort of...
Give it to us, Moses.
We didn't have an instruction manual to do this. We made it up as we went along, and we made some mistakes, but I think because we had the right instincts and the right attitude, we've got there and layer upon layer, we've got slightly better every year. But we didn't have anybody to guide us because there aren't many... Only in London will you find other comedy gigs that are open 7 nights a week. Only in London. And even then, there's only two of them. So, I mean, and the recession has had a lot of them. So there's very few places who do what we do. Not unique, but there are very, very few. I mean, obviously, I always go over to New York once a year and try and take the temperature over there. But I mean, it didn't take me too many visits to realize that actually there wasn't much that we could learn from the clubs. Certainly not the clubs in Manhattan anyway. Some of the alternative clubs outside are a little better. But, you know, I think the way we organize things, the experience we give to the customer and the audience is far superior to what happens in many clubs in other countries. So I'm not saying we haven't got anything to learn. I'm sure we have. But we've sort of, you know, worked our way through this just using instinct and attitude in getting there.
Tommy, you're a good man. I'm happy I got to meet you and get to know you this month. In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to give to the people of the earth?
People of the earth? God, no. Well, get online.
I wouldn't dare.
Yeah, but I mean, if you this is so, this is going out the week before the Scottish.
I'm going to put this on the week of Scottish Independence. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I guess what I'd say to people listening to this is that you will hear a lot of wrong things about the nature of the debate in Scotland at the moment, and be aware that those people who are campaigning for an independent country are doing so with a very outward-looking, internationalist, progressive attitude. And it is not about putting up borders. It's not about isolating ourselves. Quite the contrary. It's about finding a new self-confidence as a people and as a country so that we can play a much greater role in the world.
What's the first thing you're going to do when Scotland votes for independence?
Have a drink.
Great. Tommy Shepherd, long may you run, brother.
Thanks, Tom.
Long may you run.